So hi, welcome Richard. How are you?
Very good. Very good to see you.
Good stuff, good stuff. Let's kick off. And for our audience members that don't know about you, give me a brief intro to yourself.
So my speciality is taking findings from behavioural science and applying them to marketing. So behavioural science is just the study of how people actually behave rather than how they claim to behave. So that's what we used to call social psychology. And what I do is just take findings from that discipline, sometimes very old findings, sometimes modern ones, sometimes my own research, and just think ways that you can take experimental data and apply it to marketing in very practical ways to make that marketing more effective.
Right. I love that as a description, by the way. It's probably the most succinct description of behavioural science, how people actually behave rather than the way they think they behave. I love that. So it's a common one. Common one you see. People describe what they're doing. You think, that's not what you're doing. But how did you get into it? Are you a behavioural scientist? Were you a marketer first? Like, it's fascinating, like, that you've done.
So my background was agency. And I, you know, when I was at school, so studying psychology wasn't an option. Behavioural science wasn't really a phrase that was used. University, you know, didn't really know about this topic. So I went into marketing. And about 4 years into my role, I happened to be working for an agency whose client was the NHS. And the client was trying to encourage people to give blood. So when I was on that, like an annual planning cycle for that, I read The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell. Great book, but right at the end of that book, he mentions a psychology experiment. He mentions a study by two American psychologists called Latané and Daly, who ran a series of studies in the 1960s in which they tried to get strangers to come to the help of someone they didn't know. And their finding was that the more people you ask for help, the less likely any individual is to come to your aid. So this became known as the bystander effect. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially the idea that there is a diffusion of responsibility if multiple people are asked to help. And it just so happened, I was responding to a brief for the blood service at that time of reading that book. And I thought, well, you know, there's a danger that all the communications we're doing are falling victim to this bias, this experimental finding. And you know, we go out and ask everyone to donate blood. And just as Latané and Daly suggest, most people ignore the messaging. So I spoke to the creative agency, a lovely strategist down there called Charlie Snow, told him about this experiment I'd read about, and just made a very small suggestion that rather than say blood stocks are low in England, please donate, why don't we try and make a bit more of a tailored request? Blood stocks are low in Birmingham or Basildon or Brentwood, wherever it was. Yeah. And even that, admittedly, very, very crude, literal-minded approach, that had a significant boost to response rates. People became more likely to respond, more likely to want to donate blood, just as this 50-year-old experiment suggested. So I can remember, you know, that awakening my interest. It was like an overnight conversion, this idea that there were academics out there running studies that could give us very, very robust evidence as to what would help solve a marketing challenge. Nice. So yeah, it was a rapid introduction.
Yeah, it's great that you used it. It may have actually been in your book. I read it, but I remember the thing that struck me with the bystander event, and it stuck with me, is if you're like a first responder on an accident, rather than just say, can someone call an ambulance, point at someone and say, can you call an ambulance? You know, because otherwise, if you just shout, can someone call an ambulance? Can someone do this? Everyone's just, nothing happens. And I thought it was
I can't claim responsibility for stating that, but yeah, that would be a brilliant example of it. Yeah, it would feel like if you ask everyone to call, surely there's a greater probability, but absolutely in that scenario, especially one where people are uncertain of how to behave, you get a danger where everyone leaves it up to everyone else. Yeah. So yeah, that's a lovely example.
Fascinating. So your first book, The Choice Factory, that had 25 biases, which I found quite overwhelming, in a good way. You're like, wow, this everyone feels like a gold mine. It's like if someone says, right, in these hills, there's gold, and you go after all of them, where do I start? And you've now got a new book out, which the two questions, A, it's 16 and a half, so I'm interested in the half. So is the new book Building on the previous 25, or is this new findings, new research that you're kind of going into?
Oh, good. Yeah, good question. So it is a standalone book. If you've never read The Choice Factory, you could pick up The Illusion Choice and it'd be no worse off than somebody who's read The Choice Factory 10 times. So it's a standalone book, but it follows the same basic approach, which is identifying a series of biases, as I call them, or psychological insights. And for each chapter, that focuses on one of those insights. And the broad approach for each chapter is, here's the existing academic evidence that shows it affects people. Here's some work I've done to show it works commercially and still affects people today. And then the bulk of each chapter is, now you know about this finding. This is what you as a marketer do differently about your price, your media, your creative. So similar theme, but a completely different selection of psychological findings.
I should add for anyone, for the listeners, that it's a really simple read in that way, right? Rather than a lot of books can be maybe heavily academic and theoretical. I think you do a really good job of bridging that. So actually,
Good.
if people are looking to get into it, it's a book we talk about, because like, it's not just here's some great science. It's like, this is how you can use it to commercially be successful. And I think that's a really good way to do
Well,
it.
I'm very glad you said that because I love behavioural science. But if you read the original academic papers, they're sometimes unnecessarily overcomplicated. Some people accuse psychologists of having physics envy, and it's a phenomenally useful discipline, but there's this jealousy of physicists with their seemingly erudite formulas and equations and statistics. And unfortunately, a lot of modern psychology papers are dripping in statistics now, unnecessarily complicated jargon. So what I wanted to do was strip that away and get to the underlying idea, which is normally reasonably simple. So yeah, that's a definitely a positive from my
Good.
perspective.
I want to drill into what a couple of them are, but linked to that, when we speak to customers around the subject, it doesn't feel that behavioral science is that well adopted by a lot of departments. They love the idea of it, but they don't necessarily do much with it. Like, is that something that you see as well, or do you actually think, or and is that changing? Are people adopting it more and more? But where do you see that piece happening?
I probably have a slightly
Biased view.
unrepresentative, well, I definitely have a bias as well, but yeah. So from my impression, there has been a growth of interest in behavioural science. If I think back, I think I read that choice Tipping Point in 2004. So that's when I became interested in behavioural science. If you mention behavioural science or psychology in meetings, then you'd have to explain what it is, why it was relevant in general, and then finally get round to this is how you could use it, Mr. or Mrs. Client. Now, I think most people, or a lot of marketers, know what it is, know they should be using it, but they're not certain how they apply it to their specific challenge. So I think we have moved on. I think there's a growth of knowledge, a growth of interest, but I still would agree with you that it's not used as much as I think it should be. I think if we work in marketing, I think, maybe test this. If you work in marketing, go and find a friend or a family member who doesn't, and start trying to probe them and get them to guess how much we as an industry draw on psychology and behavioural science. And I think most people in the street would think, well, surely this is half of what you do. This is psychology is a study of what motivates people to change their behaviour. Everyone in marketing is working the business of behaviour change. So I think most people would expect we are completely immersed in this field and we're always using it. So you're right, there's a huge headroom here in which I think we can improve marketing if we get to know the field even better.
And there's two sides to that, I guess. I guess for the people who start going on with it now, it gives them a point of differentiation from the competition, and actually there's more upside for them, right? Until it's saturated.
I mean, absolutely. If you are, in many ways, I'm jealous of people who are starting out in the industry now, because if you immerse yourself in this field within a couple of years, you're going to know as much as anyone else, and or most people. And the great thing about spending time learning about behavioral science is these findings are about the fundamentals of what changes behavior. They're not going to change overnight. What motivated us in 1923 is the same as what motivates us in 2023 when you look at the basic psychological drivers. So I find that a real appeal, this topic. My background was in media, and you know, it was a frustration for me that we would spend ages learning about a new opportunity from Google or from Facebook or from whoever it was, JCDecaux. And then 6 months down the line, they've launched a new product and you have to learn it all again. It was a constant, like a hamster wheel of learning information that had a very short shelf life. Yeah. In contrast, you know, the studies from the 1960s, 70s, 80s, all these studies which tell you about drivers of behavior, they'll be relevant in marketing when on the day that we retire. So it's a wonderful discipline because the knowledge builds. The more you learn, the more opportunities there are to apply it, unlike I think a lot of other areas.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's fascinating. You know, there's this constant need for brands to put new services and ways out to reach customers, and actually human beings haven't really changed fundamentally in millions of years the way we think and are influenced. And yeah, there's maybe new ways to activate it, but I actually think it's a less stressful way to think about these things, because you're using the same principles, you're just maybe using different tools to do it, as opposed to trying to relearn everything every time and go, oh, it's another year, there's a new set of things.
So that I think that's a lovely way of describing it, because what I wouldn't want to stress is that, you know, you learn these things and then you just do the same activity again and again and again. Your phrase of there are different ways to activate is absolutely right. You know, one of the experiments that I love, because because at first I just didn't believe it and thought it was hokum, was a study about an idea called nine enders. Okay. So I covered this in The Choice Factory rather than my latest book, but it's from Hal Hirschfeld and Adam Alter. Adam Alter's at NYU. And they come up with this idea that people whose age ends in nine are particularly open to changing their behaviour. So at first it sounds like just, you know, speculative. But then they say, okay, well, there's a logic to this. It's not that being 29 or 39 or 49 is a magic number. It's just that our culture arbitrarily gives importance to the turn of a decade. Mm-hmm. So becoming 40 is a massive deal culturally. Becoming 42 isn't. So they argue, as we approach these landmark moments, our mind comes off autopilot and we at least reflect on how well our life's going. Mm-hmm. And it's simply that act of coming off autopilot that causes us to realise many of our behaviours aren't optimal and therefore change them. Now, the great thing is they don't just argue this from logic. They then go out and look at things like the age of first-time marathon runners, the age of people who've joined an affairs website called Ashley Madison, the age of people who commit suicide. And every one of these data sets shows a statistically significant increase in affairs, first-time marathon running, suicides, when people's age ends in nine. Now, that's an interesting idea, because what it essentially means is if you ever want to change people's behaviour in big ways, this is a completely counterintuitive group to target, those whose age ends in nine. But what I think's really nice about it, long-winded way of getting to your point about how you can activate it, it would have been really hard for an above-the-line agency to activate that 10, 15, 20 years ago. It'd have just been a quirk of human nature that was of interest but of no real value. Yeah. Now it's super easy to discreetly target 29-year-olds, 39-year-olds, 49. Something like Facebook has all that data. Very, very easy to target. Yeah. So I think you're right. What changes is our ability to act upon these insights, not necessarily the insight itself.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great way to put it up. Linked to that then, where does this sit within marketing? You know, is this a strategic CMO practice, or is this something, you know, if you're a digital marketer, you know, you're maybe the most junior person in the team, that you can go out, start learning about this, start applying it, and try and influence your own organization? Like, how are you seeing it adopted, and where should it be adopted, or how should it be adopted like that?
So I would argue behavioral science is the study of human nature. So it's the study of how you effectively change people's behavior. Now, if your role involves changing people's behavior, then it is a topic you can learn from. So that could be the CMO, but it could be someone involved in very tactical decisions on the first day of their career. Yeah. It's just the particular experiment you might want to draw on might vary. Yeah. So I love the fact that there are experiments that can be applied at every step along the kind of marketing journey. So nine enders, you know, very relevant to a media planner looking at what target audience to reach. You could be in pricing, for example, and apply principles from behavioral science. There's lots of studies around how to make the same price appear better value. So, for example, I did a study with Michael Aaron Flicker at XenoSci in America last year. We recruited 282 people. We split them into two groups. One group saw a 12-pack of Sierra Nevada Pale Ale for $18.99, and they were asked how good value they thought it was. And 13.7% of people thought it was good or great value. Next group, see the same brand, same pack size, same price, but we added on a few extra words. We said that's the same as $1.58 a bottle. And what we found was that the proportion of people who thought it was good or great value more than doubled. It hit just over 28%. So a tiny tweak in how you display your price, which might be relevant to someone working in shopper marketing or someone working in price setting, a tiny tweak like that can have a huge effect on people's reaction to the price. Now, that's a well-known finding in behavioral science. There's an idea called Wisiati, what you see is all there is. The idea that people don't respond to prices by drawing on all the possible information available, they give disproportionate emphasis to what's made salient, what's made obvious. So drawing someone's attention to a subunit of your price, like a small number, will make that item feel better value. And that's an interesting one for anyone at the moment when they're faced with consumers who are increasingly worrying about their budgets. You know, rather than reducing prices, you can just make your pro the same price appear better value.
I think that's a really great point that, anyone listening needs to re-listen. Like, it's not we there's a lot of talk about discounting and all of this, the associated things with the moment right now, but that isn't your only option. Interacting in a more intelligent way with your consumer and using some of these principles allows you to not erode the business, because we're naturally going to see erosion. But for people that are still buying, let's see if we can capture as much value as we can from them.
Absolutely. Maybe you have to end up discounting, but before you do that, you should apply one of the many tactics that can make the same price appear better value. So just as I've run through that study about unit reframing, what I call it, there's studies that show people think precise prices are better value than round prices. So if you go from £2 to £2.05, you look like you're better value. There's studies that show that people overemphasize costs in the now rather than costs in the distant future. So if you want to push up your price, don't tell people that you're putting through a 10% inflation-linked price next week. Tell them it's happening in 2 months' time. There are hundreds upon hundreds of these experiments you can apply to your pricing or any other aspect of marketing. Pricing was just a random selection, which doesn't cost you anything to apply, but can significantly change how people react to your price, in this case, or your product.
Now, I know that you're very much in the marketing sphere and the field, but when I read this also just felt like a management book for me. Like, do you see people coming to you from, like, CEOs who are trying to make changes in their organization? And there's a lot of principles in here that would help businesses transform quicker than a lot of the car crashes we see. Like, do you see much of that when in your work?
So that's a growing area for me. So most of my work is with brands, and it's applying these ideas to marketing. So then there's marketing's broadest sense, could be price, could be creative, could be e-commerce, but it's always the lens of behavioral science. But recently, there have been more and more people, so big pharmaceutical company, big management consultant, working with them around internal behavior change. So it's not my speciality, but frankly, a lot of the principles can be, it's the same principles, you just apply them in a different way. And I think people like behavioral science. If you're a CEO or a CMO, people like the fact that it's got this evidence base. It's not a consultant or an agency coming in speculating about what might change behavior, and the only evidence is their intuition or authority. This is all based on peer-reviewed evidence. It's not from some black box where we don't really know why it's working. You can explain a study in 2 minutes, like we've done for a couple today. And the great thing is, once you've explained the study, everyone in the room knows it well, and you can all debate then about how you apply the study. So I think that's what people like. It's kind of transparent and authoritative.
Awesome. Let me take it back to actually some of the findings. I'm sorry, I've taken us down a different path there. Now, obviously, we're not going to go into them all because people can go and buy the book. But people people who are new to this, which is the first, which is the easiest or the maybe gets the first most value for a first timer? Where would you say you're new to it? This is the bias you need to go and read about.
Oh, great question. So, one of my favorites is
You've
the
ruined
bias
my
of.
next question. I was going to say, what's your favorite
Oh,
then?
no. Okay. Well, in that case, I
I'm
won't talk about my
joking.
favorite. I
Okay,
will
cool.
go back to. No, you said earlier, why was it 16 and a half principles? And that is a principle we touched on very briefly a few minutes ago, which was there is some lovely work from Schindler at Rutgers University that shows people believe and give greater credibility, greater sense of accuracy to precise claims rather than round claims. So if I say there's 25 behavioural biases, people think I might just pluck that number out of the air. Only unfortunately, after I'd published The Choice Factory, did I read about Schindler's work. And I thought, well, I might as well apply it to my second book. So the half chapter is a short chapter on the power of precision. And the first experiment I talk about, there's probably half a dozen, maybe 10 experiments in each different chapter. So it's a study by Schindler. He recruits a group of people, shows them an ad for a deodorant. And the main claim within this ad is that it reduces perspiration by 50%. And people rate believability, accuracy of that ad. He then gets another group of people, shows them the same basic ad, but rather than have a suspiciously round claim of 50% improvement, he changes it to either 47 or 53% improvement. When that group rates believability and accuracy, believability goes up by 5%, accuracy by 10%. So it's a costless change to the messaging, which is if you use a very, very specific or precise number, people think you know what you're talking about. And that isn't, ridiculous on the consumer's part. What consumers have learned over time is that generally, if the person they're talking to knows what they're on about, they will naturally gravitate towards precise language. If I was to say to you, how old's your sister? You'd say, they're 29. If I was to say, how old's your father-in-law or your second cousin or the guy that lives two doors down the road? You'd say, I don't know, he's in his 50s. If we don't know something, we gravitate towards general language. That's the way we behave. And over time, people combine the two. So exactly the same offering can be made more believable and seem more accurate if you give people the underlying precise number rather than what most people do, which is it is round that number.
That's fascinating. What I'm going to take away and work on, because I think especially in the modern world where there's a lean towards casual conversation more, even in the workplace, I think sometimes people use round numbers to appear more casual, and better appear more relaxed in conversation. But actually, that's just erode can be eroding your authority if you know the exact number,
Yeah.
which is one of my
Well,
thoughts on.
there's a lovely book, but I think about your point of within office conversations. Maybe the most important conversation anyone has in office each year is their negotiation for a salary. There is a lovely book by Chris Rott, sorry, Chris Voss, who I think was an ex-FBI, maybe hostage negotiator,
I
called
think
Never Split the Difference.
never split the
And
difference.
one of the things that he says in that book is if you want to make a demand, salary demand, any kind of demand, don't say, I want a £1,000 raise. Say you want £1,075. Not only are you going to get more money if the person agrees to it fully, the likelihood is if someone comes back and renegotiates, the next offer they give will be much closer. And there's a lot of kind of similarities for why that might happen. I think what it suggests, if you ask that £1,075, is that you've thought through this number. This is something that is important to you. It's justified. Whereas if you say a round number, it just feels like you've plucked it out of the air, and therefore people assume that you're open to changing your ideas radically. So you can take the principle that you can use in communications in adverts, and you can take that communication principle and apply it in your negotiation tactics at work.
I love that. I used that when we bought our last house. My wife was like, why not just put this number in? It's round. I was like, no, because if I do this, it looks like I've done a calculation on paper. It was just some random numbers that made it look lumpier at the end. And it was fascinating. She was like, why does that work? So yeah, I think it's yeah, I love all of this. It's like how it all overlaps.
Yeah, there's actually there is a lovely study by Januszewski, I think it's an American, Polish American, maybe, psychologist, where he looked at house prices or for houses that were sold in Alachua County, Florida, thousands of houses. And he found exactly as you're suggesting that if you listed your house at precise price, say $501,000, you were more likely to get the asking price than if you listed at $500,000. So it's a finding that we see in a number of different areas.
Yeah,
Even
fascinating.
Uber, maybe the most robust data of all around pricing and preciseness, Uber have released data which shows that when they offer you a surge price, and they've run randomized experiments on this, if you are shown a surge price of 2.1x, you are more likely to accept that than if you are shown a surge price of 2x. So rather than as humans, as customers, weighing up whether we're prepared to pay this set amount of cash, we often just respond very quickly. And that quick rule of thumb is if it's round, it's overpriced. If it's precise, they must have marked up as little as they can. That's the, a more exact figure of what it what under the underlying cost is. So yeah, there's an awful lot of different studies that back up this precision idea.
Knowing all this, do you ever get worried about leaving the house, about how there's people influencing you at every stage? Like, I just smirk at the Uber thing. You're like, everyone's trying to catch you with these little things. You must just walk out the house thinking, right, I've got to look for absolutely everything.
Well, the interesting thing is a lot of these biases, you're using them, but you kind of still think, well, they're useful.
Yeah,
So, like,
shortcuts.
go if you go on an insurance site, you get this random list of names. What most people do is, if you've used Compare the Market or Confused, you don't pick the brand that you've never heard of. You use a rule of thumb, which is, well, I'm going to pick the first one that's of a vaguely well-known brand. I'm not going through a laborious thing of comparing the T's and C's of each and their actual value, but I'm using this principle that if it's well known, they've got loads of customers, I'm probably going to be all right because everyone else has picked them, and well, hopefully they have been using a bit of their nous in this process. So, an idea where we might pick a product based on its popularity amongst others, it might not give us the ideal answer. But it's a very good way of saving time on a decision and avoiding a catastrophic decision, because you're unlikely to be completely ripped off by an insurer that you've heard of and is popular and well known, even if you don't get the best maybe deal. You're avoiding that catastrophic mistake. So many of these biases, I think, are sensible decisions of getting a reasonable outcome on the consumer's part.
It's funny when you talk about that. So we do, when I say what we do, we're really in the network science space, which is really the study of, I think yours is about more individual bias, ours is sort of how the group influences people. And funny when you say that, we talk a lot about that. If you're a challenger brand and you're trying to be the next insurance company, it's a hard job to convince the whole of the country to buy it. But if you can find out where small social groups are talking about you and recommending, you're more likely to be able to hook into those people. Which is a really interesting space.
Oh, I think it's a fascinating area, this outsourcing of behavior to other people. So one of the studies that I've come across recently, which I find fascinating, is if you think about how most brands use social proof, it's often in quite a literal, direct way. We have 1 million customers. We're the nation's favorite cereal. But there's a lovely study from Kees Kaiser at the University of Groningen from 2008, where he shows that you don't even have to state popularity. All you have to do is imply that you're popular. So his study, he finds an alleyway in the Netherlands, loads of bikes parked, no bin nearby. He goes down in the morning and puts a flyer for a fictitious sports shop over the handlebars. He then walks away and stealthily monitors what the cyclists do when they return to their bike. And he sets up this experiment in one of two ways. So sometimes he goes down to the alleyway, cleans it up, paints the graffiti, picks up the litter, paints over the graffiti, makes the impression, makes it look as if the norm is to take your litter home because it's spotless. And in that scenario, 33% of people chuck litter on the floor. Next setup, he goes down really early in the morning on another occasion, throws litter on the floor, looks like a real tip, paints graffiti on the walls, creates the impression that most people litter. And when he does that, you get a more than doubling of littering rates. We're up to 69% now. Now, I think that's fascinating because what it means is people are not necessarily responding to the actual popularity. They're responding to the impression that you as a brand create. And suddenly that allows you all sorts of creative tactics to hack. Mm. So one that I've been told, and I can't remember who told me this. Apologies to whoever told me this. They told me that Red Bull did this brilliantly at launch. That when they were a small brand, they would go down to nightclubs just before those nightclubs were kicking people out. They would bring down big bags, big bin bags full of crushed, empty Red Bull cans. They would pour those into the bin. So when people spilled out of the nightclub, they thought, because they'd seen all these empty Red Bull cans littering around, they thought that everyone in the nightclub was powered by Red Bull. It made it look as if this was the choice of drink that was energizing everyone inside. So that, to me, is a wonderfully lateral application of this bias. It's not about, just about direct statements.
Yeah.
Now, you can use your creative nous to create the impression that your brand or the behavior you want to encourage is popular.
Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, that opens up all sorts of opportunities.
Yeah, I love that. Before we start to wrap up, I'd love to get your favourite bias then from either book, but like, what's your favourite one?
So I think favourite has to still be, and this is one I cover in the first book, The Choice Factory. I love the pratfall effect.
Okay.
It's from a series of studies by a Harvard psychologist called Elliot Aronson. He does his first study in 1966, and his study gets a colleague to take part in a quiz, gives the colleague all the answers. So the guy gets 90 or 92% of the questions right, wins the quiz by miles, looks like a genius. But then at the end of the quiz, he spills a cup of coffee down himself. So Aronson takes this recording, plays it to people, but he either plays the full version, great performance and spillage, or some people just hear an edited down version where they only hear the amazing performance. And what Aronson shows when he questions the listeners as to what they think about the contestant, he shows that the group that hear the mistake as well as the amazing performance, they rate the appeal of the contestant somewhere between 40 and 45% higher than the group who just heard the amazing quiz performance. So Aronson calls this the pratfall effect. It's essentially the idea that if you admit a flaw, you become more appealing. Now, that is fascinating because if you look at the greatest ever adverts, that tactic appears again and again and again. Now, Guinness, good things come to those who wait. Stella, reassuringly expensive. Avis, we're number two, but we try harder. VW, ugly is only skin deep. You could, Marmite, you know, half the people bloody hate us, half of them love us, whatever that line is exactly. It's amazing. If you listed the 100 best campaigns ever, I think about a quarter of them, maybe, would harness the pratfall effect. And it's powerful because it's a distinctive tactic.
Yeah.
Even though it's very common amongst successful, very successful campaigns, it's very rare in general. So because it's distinctive, it's noticeable. It also gets around the trust problem. You know, why would I trust a brand? I know that they're trying to sell me something, so of course they're going to say they're amazing. But if you admit a flaw as a brand, if you say you're really expensive, like Stella do, well, you then trust them and you believe their next point that they're high quality. And then the final strength, and this is where it goes from being a quite good bias to an amazing bias, is those best brands have recognised that in many cultures, weaknesses have mirror strengths. So if you're Guinness and you say good things come to those who wait, you admit that there's a frustrating delay to getting your pint of beer.
Mm-hmm.
What people have in their mind is an existing trade-off that things that are high quality are harder to get. Things that are high quality often take longer to make. So by admitting the right flaw, you can emphasize your underlying strength. So if you talk about your priciness, you're emphasizing your quality. If you talk about your ugliness as a VW Beetle, you're emphasizing that you don't really care about aesthetics. You care about engineering excellence. If you pick the right flaw, the pratfall effect, I think, is probably one of the most powerful communication techniques there is.
I love that. That's a great one for people. And I think it also shows maturity, right? Because Think about younger people, they're very showy and like I'm the best. And then when people mature, then they maybe are a bit more open and they're the people you generally trust. So you can kind of see how this is what I love about the subject. Like when you start to pick it apart, it makes sense. That's the beauty of it. There's all the evidence, which is great, and you're like, yeah, I makes total sense. Which
And
is
the nice thing
great.
is, I mean, maybe less than the practical, less for the practical effect than others, because it's not such a well-researched bias. But even for the practical effect, once you start digging into it, there are modifying characteristics. So, exactly as you said, there is an argument from some psychologists that if you have status, admitting a flaw is very, very powerful. If you are low status and you admit a flaw, it's either less powerful or may even backfire. So what it might be that once you know learn these nuances, you can pick the situations in which this is the right bias to use. So you're absolutely right. It's a topic that rewards eternal efforts. The brilliant thing is human nature. Human nature is so complex and fascinating. You can spend forever learning these little intricacies and nuances.
Yeah, awesome. Look, I've loved the chat. I could keep going, but I'm gonna draw it to an end. Where can people get hold of the book? I only say that because I know, I think in Amazon in the UK, we were trying to get some and you're out, so I just want to make sure people can actually find
So
the
that's all
book.
sorted
Is
now.
that
It
sorted? Okay,
did sell
great.
out.
Okay.
I think it sold 6,000 in the first 48 hours, which was a bit of a
Awesome.
surprise. So it did sell out, but it's
Cool.
back in again. So
Okay.
basically, Amazon, WH Smith, Waterstones, whatever bookstore people prefer, you can get it.
And given the title that they're Googling for, other search engines are available.
So yeah, the first book's The Choice Factory, and the second book is The Illusion of Choice.
Perfect. And both available now. Yep.
Absolutely,
Great. Look, thanks for coming on, Richard. Really enjoyed the
Fantastic.
conversation. And yeah, I'll speak to you again soon.
Fantastic. Well, great to chat. Speak to you soon. Thanks a lot.